across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
So, on the podcast from the Nolan Show this morning, good morning, by the way, Gavin Robertson says that there will be a new DUP, new ways of working both internally and externally. Well, what does he mean by that? And then you had the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn. And Hilary Benn was saying that the Windsor framework will be implemented with proportionality. What does that mean? How do you implement something with proportionality? Does that mean that the entire Windsor framework is not being implemented? And if it does, what bits are they cherry-picking? What bits are they not? That coming up this morning, along with some callers who, let's just put it like this, didn't seem too happy for me to be back. It's just like my team. All coming up on the podcast this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining me today. Politics at the top of the show this morning. So what did Gavin Robinson actually mean when he said the old days of how the DUB did business are over? Have a listen.
And in the coming months, we will be engaging with our communities in every part of Northern Ireland as a new approach under my leadership. I am determined that in the remaining months of 2024, you will see that with a new leader, there will be a new approach, both internally and externally, as to how we do business, which will be people-centred and focused on getting the right outcomes for the lives of all of our people.
The Education Minister, Paul Given, with us this morning. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
My goodness, there are a lot of people who have been in your party a long time. Should they be worried? A new approach internally and externally. Has Gavin delivered the message as to how you're all going to change?
Well, I've been in the party a very long time, as have my family, because I'm a third generation member. And I have to say that I was very much encouraged with Gavin Robinson's speech on Saturday, the conference. It was an upbeat one, and we had new faces coming forward. And I think that's what, you know, Gavin is speaking about. It's that new generation of unionism stepping forward. We had younger members taking part. You had Jonathan Buckley, Cheryl Brownlee, and new MLAs who we will be putting out there, and they will be the face of our party driving that agenda for people's priorities.
That's not, Paul, the only thing he was talking about. That speech was written. The words would have been checked. That's a message to your party internally, a new approach internally. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is, in my role as Education Minister, Gavin Robinson sitting down with me saying, Paul, here's the priorities that the people expect us to deliver on. Childcare, that has been top of our list, an Assembly manifesto commitment. And Gavin saying, Paul, you need to drive that forward. And that's the job that I have been doing. And we just heard on your news bulletins, we've 12,000 families receiving that support, up to £167 off the costs of their costs. That is the DUP focused on people's priorities.
So when Gavin talks... I'm going to talk to you about that. I'm going to talk to you about childcare. I'm going to talk to you about the policies. But didn't Sir Geoffrey Donaldson sit down with each minister and talk about what mattered to people? Didn't Peter Robinson? This is Gavin Robinson talking about a new approach. Didn't your other leaders care? Or what is he saying is going to be different?
Well, of course, previous leaders cared about delivering on people's priorities.
So what's
new? What Gavin has brought is very much a forensic focus on that, looking at the departments, saying to me, what are we doing on special educational needs provision, childcare, uniform costs, and other people's priorities? And so when we talk about our policies and we look at our policies, the focus there is on how does that impact upon the people? How does it impact upon young people? And to make sure that then we deliver on it. So that is the focus of our party. So the conference was an excellent conference, one that we've walked away from saying, let's roll the sleeves up, get out there, engage in our communities. We have a story to tell about how we are working at that grassroots level, trying to make sure we support them. And that's what I'm doing.
So can I cut to the chase?
Colleagues are doing everywhere.
Can we cut to the chase then? Is your party saying that the days where your central message was keep the bogeymen out, keep the shinners out, is that gone? Are you now talking about your party being focused? Because you haven't always been, many people would argue, on policy. There's a lot of sectarianism in Northern Ireland. There's a lot of playing the flag in Northern Ireland, and any party could be accused of that. Is your party abandoning that?
Well, Gavin outlined where he sees the party and how he wants Northern Ireland to represent everybody. And that's our British identity. It's also our Irish identity. And I've taken steps as Education Minister to go out and embrace the very different sectors that exist, including within Irish medium. And that's where Gavin is saying that a Northern Ireland confident and secure in itself, respecting each other's traditions, including those emerging communities. Well, if you're content and you're able to feel a place and be part of our home, then that in itself will lead to Northern Ireland having a securer place within the United Kingdom. And that's what we want to see as a party, where people recognise the value of our country and then wanting to remain within the UK. So why then would you want to change that? So our focus is on making Northern Ireland work. That's what it's about, and across all of our different areas.
And there might, Paul, be some people this morning, there might be quite a few people this morning, hailing this, congratulating you, and wondering why it took your party so long to realise that it's the bread and butter issues that matter here rather than a flag.
Well, our party has had to respond to things that came about over the past number of years. And I look at the referendum that took place, a UK-wide referendum in terms of our relationship with the European Union. And the outworkings of that created huge instability, particularly whenever unionism's voice wasn't being
listened to. Your party championed Brexit, own it.
So whenever we had to respond to the outworkings of that referendum, whenever the Conservative government decided to treat Northern Ireland differently, we had to respond to that. And that has created a significant level of instability and turbulence. And so we've continued to chip away at making progress in those areas. But we also are making it clear that we will deliver on all of the bread and butter issues and make the case that we are making around additional investment. But we continue to work on other things.
I want to get into those bread and butter issues with you, Paul, literally within the next minute or so. But look, if this is a new beginning from a new leader, rather than the words that he's used about we should have employed cautious realism, like, what does that mean to someone walking up a street? Did your party spoof to the unionist people? Have you been caught doing it? And do you need to admit that you spoofed and deployed deceit with the unionist people to everybody in Northern Ireland when you suggested the Irish Sea border was gone? Like, just listen to this. This is only months ago.
For the movement of goods within the United Kingdom, the protocol, of course, imposed severe restrictions on the movement of those goods. These new arrangements remove those restrictions.
Zero paperwork.
Yes, zero checks, zero customs paperwork on goods moving within the United Kingdom. That takes away the border within the UK between Northern Ireland and Great Britain.
Were the people spoofed to there?
Well, so Gavin reset the party's position on this a number of months ago.
He stood beside Sir Geoffrey Donaldson when Geoffrey Donaldson was saying it. So has the party spoofed to the unionist people, and is this a reset?
No, we haven't. And what we have done, though, is respond to those who acted in a reckless manner when it came to placing Northern Ireland in a different position to the rest of the United Kingdom. This idea that the DUP is somehow responsible for Conservative governments acting in the way that they did is a nonsense. But what we do have to enact is our response to that. We got a command paper. I don't step away from anything within the UK's command paper because we made progress. And that's what the DUP does. We identify the challenges and then we work to deliver on them. Now, some of the delivery of that is still yet to come. And therein lies the challenge for us as a party. But we've built in mechanisms through independent monitoring panels now in place. We've also strengthened a statutory duty to review the Windsor framework when there was a vote later this autumn. Let me finish the point, Stephen. Gavin said at the conference on Saturday, he appeals to all unionists to vote with us as we will be voting against the Windsor framework arrangements. That will automatically trigger a statutory duty to review all of the outworkings of that, and then we continue to use the evidence that that will garner to press for further change.
It is about the test, Paul, for the ordinary bloke walking up and down a street, going to work, going to a factory, going in to stand in a shop for 10 hours a day and maybe taxiing at night time, doing two and three jobs in order to pay the bills. It is the test for them. They don't understand this language of cautious realism. You've got to get a dictionary out to understand some of it. The bottom line is, do those people believe that you did not spoof to them, your party did not spoof to them just a matter of moments ago? Do you apologise to them if you did? Are you asking them for a second chance, or are you pretending still the Irish Sea border's gone?
No, the party delivered progress when it came to the command paper. That's what we delivered upon. And there has to be the fulfilment of a number of those commitments, which the Labour Party also voted for at Westminster. And so the pace of change I would want to see happening much quicker. But we will use all of the tools that we have at our disposal that we secured in the command paper. We have the Stormont break. We have the scrutiny committee at Stormont that is allowing us to cast our eyes upon everything that's happening. Then we use that evidence to press for further change.
Okay.
That's why you're not getting things like the changes around movement of parcels, which was supposed to happen this Christmas, because we used the evidence and made the case to the UK government through our MPs, and that has allowed those measures to be postponed for now. But we continue to use all of the tools at our disposal that the DUP secured. What? While others complain, criticise, we get into detail and we make the progress.
When Hilary Benn was talking at the weekend, he said this, Paul.
I'm very conscious of the pressures that the Windsor framework creates, and there will be new issues coming along. And Nick Thomas-Simmons and myself, working with politicians and businesses in Northern Ireland, are keen to try and work our way through that. We are going to implement the Windsor framework, but as I've said many times before, with pragmatism and proportionality, because there is a prize at the end of this process, and it is the SPS veterinary agreement that this government is committed to negotiating.
So, there will be new issues coming along. That's clear code, isn't it, Paul? That there are going to be there's going to be controversy in Northern Ireland when this place is set apart from the rest of the UK. They've said they're going to implement the Windsor framework. So what's your party going to do about that if it sets this place apart from the rest of the UK? And then he talks about implementing it with proportionality. Does that mean cherry picking it? What did he mean?
Well, what we know is that the Labour government want to take the United Kingdom as a whole closer to the European Union. Gavin outlined how that is likely, though, to take a number of years. And as the Labour government pursue that objective, our clear objective in that is to make sure that Northern Ireland's place within the United Kingdom is strengthened. And that's why we secured things like the East-West Council, Intertrade UK, bodies which allow us to make the case for that closer integration of Northern Ireland within the UK.
When he's talking about new issues, he's talking about new problems. What are they?
Well, there'll always be new challenges, opportunities and problems within politics. What's important is that the infrastructure is in place to allow us to respond to that. That's what we secured through a democratic process at Stormont through the Windsor negotiations. And we have now the ability to have that level of scrutiny. We have a Stormont break that can be applied. That triggers various different processes. So whatever the issues are,
the Stormont break doesn't stop anything, does it, ultimately? The British government can continue with it. You know it.
Well, whatever the issues are, we now have much clearer visibility on all of that, and we have much higher levels of democratic input through the Stormont institutions. So that's what's important.
Right.
Undoubtedly, there will be challenges that come, but we now have an ability to address those challenges.
But can you give the people that listen to me a heads up? These new issues that the Secretary of State is talking about and related to the Windsor framework, can you give us a heads up as to what you see the problems being here, let's say for the rest of this year, the next 6-12 months? What are they?
Well, I look at one of the commitments that we received in the command paper, which was the continued supply of veterinary medicines beyond 2025. That is something which is hugely significant to our agriculture.
That's not
community.
A new problem. That's sorted to a degree.
Well,
it's not sorted.
It's not sorted because that's why we had to get the commitment that they would ensure continued supply beyond 2025. So that is one issue that we need to see the government working with us and the European Union on to ensure that we have that continued supply.
Let me talk to you, Paul, about the bread and butter issues. Your party clearly this morning is saying that you're doing your best for people with families in terms of childcare. What have you delivered?
Well, I look at one of the flagship commitments that we made in our manifesto, childcare. And that was one that Gavin was very clear with me that he expected delivery upon. And within 6 months, not only was a scheme designed, the infrastructure was put in place. And this month, we have had those payments being made to hardworking families. We now have over 12,000 families having signed up to that. We've nearly 1,500 childminders and nursery daycare providers that are signed up to that. And that is delivering real impact.
What does it deliver
for those families? Well, you get a 15% subsidy on top of the 20% tax-free childcare allowance that you get from Westminster. And that was the system that I built in so that you would get, in effect, a third off your childcare bills for those who are signed up and registered to those schemes. And I've already met families who have said to me, Paul, I've now had a reduction of, for some, it's £167. For others, it could be £100. It depends on how many hours you have.
And it's implemented through the tax system, or where do you get that additional 15% in Northern Ireland from?
So that is implemented through a Northern Ireland-specific subsidy scheme, and you apply that to the childcare providers, and that then has a reduction in the bill that those providers are asking for the parents of the children to pay. So you get that reduction at source, and the scheme has been established and set up for child care providers to receive that reduction whenever it comes to the bill that they then invoice people to. So that is DUP delivering on those child care issues. But I also came into office needing to create over 1,000 additional places, and you've focused on this a lot for children with additional needs. But not only did we create 1,000 places, we've actually added 1,450 new places in our school system. That's 183 more classes. Now, that has been responding.
Where'd you get the money from? Is that all based on a projected overspend?
No, that is within my department. I've had to prioritise capital spend, and that's why today your earlier programmes have highlighted Holy Family Church in Macrofelt that I visited. It's not a special school, and therefore schools like that aren't getting the level of capital investment that I would want to give them, because we've had to prioritise the needs of children that require special support. So there is prioritisation for those children. But again, the system had to respond, and I had to lead that response and set in place processes to do that. And that's why now every child does have a place in September. It is a better position than last year, but it's still not where I want us to be in terms of much better advanced planning, so we're not faced with the same pressures next year. I outlined a new capital investment strategy specifically for those with special education needs.
So
and you asked again what we delivered, Stephen, because I think this is really important about how Stormont must respond to people. We settled industrial action, teachers pay, but within that, I recognised that new graduates on £23,000 was nothing like what the counterparts were receiving in the rest of the UK, and that's why now we moved that to £30,000. And then you also focused on classroom assistance, and I remember you had a number of people on, and we've just settled the industrial dispute. There's a new pay and grading scale system being brought in to help the recruitment and retention for classroom assistance. So that's a DUP minister supported by Gavin, led by Gavin, directing me on where I need to be and working on and having a real tangible impact for the people of Northern Ireland.
And can I be clear, are you able to achieve all of those things you've laid out there within the budget you have been given?
So the challenge that I have is we have significant pressures, and I've highlighted this repeatedly to my executive colleagues, And this is where the executive has been working with the Treasury to provide additional resource. So I do have significant pressures this year. We have money that are available.
Can you commit to working within your budget?
Well, I
not overspending.
So I am driving saving exercises, and it is leading to a reduction in services.
The question is, can you commit to remaining within your budget?
Well, I'm committed to doing everything I can to live within our budget, but there is money that is available to us. That's why I was disappointed.
Everything you can does not mean a commitment to live within your budget. Will your permanent secretary intervene, warn you, stop you overspending, just like Hugh Wittes from the Department of Justice has warned the Chief Constable?
Well, here's the reality of some of the pressures that we face. Haven't secured that uplift in teachers' pay, and rightly so. And that is something that is then reflected in our baseline as a department, which I didn't receive. So if you want the Department of Education to live within its current budget, and I am confident that I will secure additional resources, you would need to be making one quarter of our teaching profession compulsory redundant. Now, that's not something that I think anybody supports. It would have a severe detrimental impact on our education system. Look, that's why I make the case, and this is the point I want to make, Stephen, now. This is why whenever Sinn Féin were at the Labour Party conference, rather than focus on a border poll, which they have talked about at length for years, Gerry Adams thought it would come in 2016, now the latest target's 2034, our laser-like focus needs to be on additional investment into Northern Ireland, not chasing pipe dreams, but focused on the bread and butter delivery for Northern Ireland. And that's where our focus, political parties should be focused
upon. Just said, Paul, a matter of minutes ago, that Gavin Robinson and your party are committed to people, no matter what their identity is, their British and Irish identity. How are you respecting people who want to have an Irish identity, who have an Irish identity, if you're calling their aspiration for a united Ireland a pipe dream?
Well, the pursuit of the border poll agenda by Sinn Féin is a distraction from where we should be all focused on in terms of public services. And Gavin...
But a pipe dream? Like, is that respectful of people that want a united Ireland? A pipe dream?
Just look through. In 2011, Gerry Adams said we would be in the united Ireland by 2016. Then he changed it to 2024. Then Mary Lou in May 2022 said the change would come in 2027. And now Michelle O'Neill says it's 2034. Well, what I am appealing to everybody within the executive, let's focus on public services. I very much have a broad view of what Northern Ireland needs to be within the United Kingdom, and that is one that respects our Irish, British and other identities. That is the way we will secure Northern Ireland's place within the Union.
I've only got a couple of minutes before the news. Look, it's clear that what your party's trying to do this morning, wants to do, is doing this morning, is talking about bread and butter issues. That's clearly a strategy from your party, and many people might congratulate you for it. So let's talk, for example, about what your party would do with the current policing situation in Northern Ireland. You have a Chief Constable saying he cannot police this place safely with the budget he's been given. Hard choices at Stormont. Where would you take the money from? I get it. Well, the easy answer is we want more from Westminster. They might not give it to you. So in terms of this laser focus, where would you take the money from?
Well, we do have additional funding coming, and there is discussions ongoing within the executive as to how we can support not just my department and the Department of Health, but also when it comes to policing. And our party has been supportive of the Chief Constable in terms of the case that he has been making. I think it's the right case that he has been putting out, and has went to the Prime Minister for that. And that is something that our party is supporting, because there is a national security element to the PSNI's budget. That is something that needs to be taken into account in terms of direct funding from London, but also when it comes to the allocation of funding within Northern Ireland's budgetary process. We are wanting to support the PSNI. So those conversations will continue in terms of what we can do as an executive, but also what support can be achieved from Westminster in terms of the national security aspect.
You've answered that by not telling me any prioritisation for police funding within the Northern Ireland Block grant.
Well, because there are a number of significant pressures, not least in my own department.
Which is why there has to be hard choices. Would there be a prioritisation for the police above other departments if the DUP, has the DUP decided that? Where in the pecking order does policing come?
Well, I'm not going to go into the minutiae of all of our conversations, but the police and supporting the PSNI budget is a priority for us in terms of what funding is available to the executive to consider. But we also have priorities in terms of education. I know my colleague Gordon Lyons is also focused on getting additional support for new housing that we need to be providing.
Well, if you want to support Irish identity, maybe you should get Casement Park built.
Well, again, those are issues that the executive will consider in that respect. But the UK government took a particular approach to Casement Park. They talked about providing funding, and we said there was a tripartite approach, a three sporting body approach to that, which we stand over. And it's important that if the UK government decide to give a differential approach to one sporting body, that wouldn't be the right approach to take. And therefore, they would need to be taking any decisions in the context of what we need for all of the different sporting bodies and the previous agreement that was put in place.
If we take Gavin's speech at the weekend and delivering for people, some of that is going to be about making, I've mentioned this a couple of times already, tough decisions, actually doing government, making decisions, saying this is tough. Yes, and you've done it today in saying you're prioritising children with special educational needs above some other schools. With regards to revenue raising, Paul, in other words, taking money from either a lot of us or the richest in Northern Ireland and redistributing it, is the DUP up for revenue raising in Northern Ireland as part of this new laser focus on policy, local policy?
Well, what the public expect whenever they contribute towards our public services, that they receive the right support at the right time. And that isn't the case as things stand. So before you would be raising revenue in other areas of public sector, you would need to make sure that you can demonstrate that this will lead to transformational change. You also need to demonstrate that you're operating as efficiently as possible in terms of all of the various different public services that are being provided. And that's why I've went about a piece of work within the Education Authority. There needs to be significant transformation. I believe that the transformation that will take place, setting up an effective administration, will have a benefit in terms of the amounts of money that will be saved. And that's where we need to drive out all of those efficiencies.
Can I give you an example?
And then you use that to invest in the public sector.
Can I give you an example within your brief? So tuition fees here in Northern Ireland, Paul, Minister, are cheaper than elsewhere in the UK. It's fantastic. Except you could put up tuition fees and you could redistribute that money if you thought it was a good idea into some of the most deprived areas, to some of the children who need help the most. Would you consider raising tuition fees?
Well, tuition fees isn't actually my responsibility, but it's obviously an issue that the wider executive would look at. But when it comes to tuition fees, I think we need to be very clear. When young people decide to go to university, they do incur significant expense as a result of that.
If we raised them to the same level as GB, it would raise 98 million. Let's get into the bread and butter issues on this programme this morning. 98 million.
And so how many people would then decide not to go to university? Because I already know from speaking to young people, when I go in and out of schools, they say to me, even if in Northern Ireland they stayed in a university, the level of fees is something that they already take into account as to whether or not they go to university.
Ian Emerson in the Irish News called it a middle-class subsidy at the weekend.
So when you consider these issues, you do need to weigh up all of the various pros and cons. And that's what we are doing as a part in all of our different public services. What is going to have the most impact for people? How do we support people? And that will require decisions to be taken. I'm already having to take difficult decisions within my department to try and make sure that we can live within our means. But all of these
things. What are they, Paul? Spell out. Are there any decisions you've taken that we don't know about yet in terms of tough decisions?
Well, I would have liked to be stated, for example, that as a result of budget. I haven't been able to do that. Other MLAs have called on me to do it, and I've had to hold the line on that. That's not something that I want to be in a position to do. I would like to change that position, but I'm not able to. The resources aren't there. And there's other decisions that I've had to take that I have found very difficult.
I know you need to go, so this is the final question. Will we really find a new DUP? Is this simply a new leader saying it's new because I'm here, I'm new? Or do you really think we will see a new DUP different from what it's been in the past?
Well, what I am saying already under Gavin's leadership is much drive and determination from him, but also from the way that he encourages all of my colleagues in the Assembly to be on the front foot, very much proactive in all of the committees, the chambers, but importantly out there in the communities. And I can see that real drive and purpose, because there is a bigger picture and a vision that the DUP has for Northern Ireland. And we have a collective responsibility, not just for Gavin to lead us. We have to join him in that effort. And that's what I'm seeing already happening. And I think you will see a further step change in that approach as he continues to change internally, and that will then have an impact in terms of our external output as well.
Okay. Minister, thank you for all your time this morning. We appreciate it. That's Paul Given from the DUP. So what do you make of this then? The DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, saying that things are going to change within his party. He's talking about a new DUP. Fred, first call of the day. Do you buy it, Fred?
Hello, how are you? No, when I heard those terms, we heard this term used before, when there was a new decade, new approach. At that time, I said it was just a new approach to more of the same, and likely that's what this will be too.
Well, why not give them a chance?
Well, when the Prime Minister was elected, he took his chance within a few days, and he has been elected for some days too. He hasn't made much room anyhow, or made much change, but I mean, he must remember he's playing the second fiddle to Sinn Féin, so he'd be limited to what he can do.
Fred, thank you. Paul, morning, Paul.
All right, Stephen.
Go ahead, Paul.
Stephen, look, the DUP tries to distance themselves from the Irish Sea border, but if you look at the near history there, the DUP own the Irish Sea border, but they deny it. Because if you go back to the time when Theresa May was sitting in Brussels and she got the backstop sent off, she got a phone call from Arlene Foster and Nigel Dodds to tell her that they couldn't sell that to the unionist people. But the reality was this: Arlene Foster, Nigel Dodds, Ian Paisley Jr., and Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, they were doing the big deal. They'd done the great deal, that says, and the deal was this, that they brought down her government so as they could get in the bed with a Eurosceptic party. And that happened. The same Eurosceptic party took power after Arlene Foster was put out. And not Arlene Foster, Theresa May was kicked out. They took power of that party. The DUP had a huge hand to play in bringing her down, because that backstop was not brought in because of them. And when they went and jumped in the bed with
Paul,
them for that party...
Why are you going back then? Why not talk about now? Why not talk about right now?
But this is I'm talking about right now. They are trying to distance themselves from the Windsor framework. They try to distance themselves from the border, the Irish Sea border. The reality is the DUP, where's Ian Paisley now? Where's Donaldson now? Where's Arlene Foster?
You talk about the Windsor framework.
Yep.
And the number this morning is 030-30-80-55-55. With regards to the Windsor framework, listen to what Hilary Benn said at the weekend.
We are going to implement the Windsor framework, but as I've said many times before, with pragmatism and proportionality, because there is a prize at the end of this process.
So what does that mean, with proportionality? You're either going to implement it or not.
Yeah.
So how are you going to implement it with proportionality? Like, what does that mean? One of the key questions today is, what does that mean? Are they going to cherry pick? What does he mean?
He's just going to implement it in full. It's as simple as that. And the DUP have to own that. Sinn Féin didn't create it. The Irish government didn't create it. It was the European Union, the British government. But the DUP turned their back on Theresa May's deal. Okay. It was going to be better.
Paul, thank you. Professor John Tong from the University of Liverpool is with us this morning. Morning to you, John.
Good morning.
Now, you've described the DUP as a desperately unhappy party. Actually, what you had there at the weekend was Gavin Robertson talking about a new beginning, and they're at least claiming they're going to do what many people in Northern Ireland have wished that they would do, some not, but some have said, why don't you actually concentrate on issues that matter to us? But Given did not mention the colour of a flag. Flags are constitutional position once in that interview. He was talking about education. He was asked about policing. Is that not what people want?
It is what people want. I mean, just for context, I described desperately unhappy party, or decidedly unhappy party was the term I used, in the past tense. The party is actually more united than it's been in a while now, because they all do support Gavin Robinson's leadership. It was a very, very low-key conference. It was the quietest, most subdued DUP conference I've ever attended, and numbers were way down. But the party is relatively united. It knows it can't go back to it's struggling. The problem for the DUP is it's struggling to find the direction it wants to go in. What do you do? How do you analyse an election result where you've lost a seat to the TUV, you've lost a seat to the Ulster Unionist Party, you've lost a seat to Alliance? There's no easy political direction to go down. So a lot of buzzwords were used on Saturday: reset, rebrand, relaunch, refire, etc. But there was no clarity as to what political direction the DUP will take. What the DUP was stressing was, we're going to be about the party of delivery. So Paul Gibbons' achievements as an executive minister were highlighted. You know, childcare, early learning, ban on mobile phones in schools, etc. So it's about delivery and trying to get functional competence. You wouldn't associate the term functional competence necessarily with the DUP over the last 7 or so years.
But they've got a new leader. If Gavin Robinson and his party got that message through, you now have cheaper childcare because of us. If that started filtering through in other departments, would that protect the union?
Yeah, the better the union works, the more likely you are to find people supporting the union. It's when the union isn't working and when the parties representing the union are not good ambassadors for that union because they're squabbling either amongst themselves or within themselves. That's when the union is in jeopardy. If you've got a functioning Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom, then that, you know, might assuage the pressures upon the union. But frankly, you've had, you know, collapsed devolved government for nearly 70% of the time over the last 7 years. How is that possibly an advert for Northern Ireland's place within the union? The DUP knows that. I mean, it was a much, much more reflective conference on Saturday than I've ever known the DUP. There was none of the flag waving. It was about, OK, where have we gone wrong and what do we need to do to address that and to rebuild the voter coalition of unionists that Lee Reynolds talked about in his critique of the party last week.
Let me bring in Alex Kane, former Director of Communications, also Unionist Party commentator. Morning, Alex.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Look, when Robinson was talking about a new beginning for the party, he was definitely signalling a message that the old days of how the DUP does business are over. Does that mean, well, if we get down to the nitty-gritty of this, does he have to drive out some of the older decision-makers who are at the top of that party?
Well, there's certainly going to be internal friction over this, Stephen. I mean, I've talked to you before, John, I know this as well. I mean, the Ulster Unionist Party went through this sort of crisis 10, 15 years ago, and it's a huge internal civil war for years, and they settled themselves. I think for the DUP and what Gavin has to do right now, his big problem is that this is not just him taking over from Donaldson in very difficult circumstances. This goes back to the time when Arlene Foster was coming under enormous internal pressure. She went reluctantly, Edwin Puts a few weeks, then Jeffrey, then Gavin. A lot of those problems that led to that, you know, that sort of toppled down leader one after the other, those problems are still there. It was interesting, we saw Nigel Dodd sounding very upbeat, we're all behind Gavin and so on, because go back to the end of January when they were discussing the deal to get the Assembly up and running. Nigel Dodd, Sammy Wilson, Ian Paisley, June, a lot of other people in the party, not happy with that deal. They've not been happy with the fallout of some of that deal. But what I think was maybe the most interesting part of what Gavin said, and it was echoed in a number of other places, the DUP will not bring down the Assembly. And I think there are two reasons they say that. One, they're sending a message to the government. You know, we like your line. We like what you're saying about proportionality and even-handedness when it comes to the Windsor framework. We know you're going to implement it. We're not going to be really, really difficult. We're not going to just collapse and walk off the top. But also, I think that we're saying to the government, if we can give you stability in the sense that this party is not going to walk, that is where the treasurer, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, might think, okay, I'm not just doling out money to the Assembly that's going to collapse in a matter of months. You're sort of saying to those people, we are offering you stability. And that may have gone over the heads of some of the people at the audience, although I did talk to two who said to me, we've given our best card away. If we say we're not going to collapse everything, we've given our best card away. But I think what Gavin wants to put in place is this sense that the DUP has difficulties, but they are difficulties which can be addressed, and he's not going to use the Assembly stability as a means of addressing them.
I'm trying to get a sense from you both this morning as to whether there is much depth in this. Have a listen to this.
In the remaining months of 2024, you will see that with a new leader, there will be a new approach, both internally and externally, as to how we do business, which will be people-centred.
You see, a new approach internally as to how we do business. If he actually means that, John, that's some pretty tough talking to very powerful people who are very happy with how they've always done business.
Yeah, and I think Gavin Robinson will stop the solo runs that were undertaken by some very prominent members of the DUP until very recently.
Well, how's he going to stop Sammy Wilson, for example?
Well, it'd be very, very difficult. I mean, therein lies the problem that you've
and
got.
That's just one example I use.
But I mean, what he's going to do is try and restructure the party. So you've got a new director of party development in place, but you've also got to have much greater internal discipline and people being on message in a way you've not seen at times within the DUP. That's mighty difficult. Then there's the reliance upon policy delivery that we've talked about. How are you going to do that when there's no extra money for Northern Ireland? I mean, I'm at the Labour Party conference, and I can tell you, first of all, Northern Ireland's on the fringes of that conference. It's not mainstream. And the idea, as Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves today, the Chancellor, will be, you know, offering tough love to that conference. The idea that extra money can be found for Northern Ireland's ministers to deliver, including the DUP ones, some of the biggest spending ministers. I mean, again that's fantasy. So therein lies the difficulty ahead for the DUP.
David Graham joining us as well this morning, former DUP Special Advisor. Morning, David.
Good morning, Stephen.
You see, he didn't just say that a new approach as to how we do business externally, in other words, public facing. He has talked about a new way of the DUP doing business internally. So that's a warning, messaging, call it what you want from the new leader. Things are going to change inside this party. Does he have the power to do it?
Look, I think, Stephen, that is the million-dollar question. You know, I believe that Arlene Foster knew that the party needed restructured, and she made some attempts to do so. I think Edwin Poots knew it as well, but he didn't have the time to do it. And I think by the time Sir Geoffrey had came to power, he simply didn't have the wriggle room, given the amount of sort of internal damage the party, self-inflicted damage the party did in that leadership spot in 2021. So, look, Gavin will know. You can see even simple and small subtle signs, like who some of the speakers were on Saturday, the age of the speakers, you know, the gender and the demographic that they represented. You know, Gavin is not a stupid man. I believe that he is a strategist. I believe that he can see what needs to be done. But I think John Tong mentioned it earlier. You know, the party lost three seats, quite frankly, one to the left, one to the right, and one to the centre a number of months ago. That's serious damage. But again, you know, even in difficult times, there may be opportunities there. And I think when maybe someone had mentioned there the solo run, someone like maybe Ian Paisley Jr. would have been known for a solo run. You know, there has been certainly mentioned that some people have breathed almost a sigh of relief when Ian lost his seat. And I think from that point of view, Gavin knows what needs to be done. There are 3 years, Stephen, in which, you know, change can be made. But it's a very difficult one, because no matter how you try to square the circle, there is not one simple solution, because you've got Jim Allister's TUV targeting that more traditional DUP vote of old. You then have the Alliance who are looking at the more liberal end of unionism. and the Ulster unionists have shown they're not dead and buried with Robin Swan's victory. So there's a lot of food for thought, and I think, you know, the one thing that I would say is if Gavin's going to change internally, is that going to be a change of personnel? Will Gavin be prepared to...
How do you get rid of people who've been in that party years? And by the way, should they be... With people who've been there for years comes a lot of experience.
Well, look, what you've got to bear in mind is that, you know, the DUP, and as recently as 2016, in fact, Alex, who's on the call, has written, and pardon me, Alex, if I don't quote you exactly word for word, but he wrote an article after the DUP party conference, which said, in paraphrasing, you know, Arlene Foster is the mistress of all that she surveys, and essentially, unless they drop the ball, unless arrogance takes over, she can be as leader for as long as she wants. Now, Gavin Robinson, in many ways, is in a very similar position, albeit a much weaker position. Arlene was First Minister. The DUP were the biggest party. But Gavin, I believe, can be the leader for as long as really he wishes. I don't get any sense of any internal pressure on that position
at all. Does the public feel that they are delivering on those bread and butter issues that they now say they're going to focus on? Dave in Belfast, thanks for calling us. What do you think, Dave?
Hi, are you? I don't think the DUP are going to change that much, you know. And I'll tell you why I don't think, Stephen, because see when they come around the working class districts, right, they're waving the flag, they're putting out flyers that say we're the only party in fight Sinn Féin, right? So they get their votes that way. Then they go off and they play Camogie up a Falls Road with Sinn Féin. Then your mate, we call him Paul, whatever was on, he's Paul doing Kevin. His Irish dancing. Adam puts his fly in these Gaelic language signs and storming. So they're insulting people. They don't follow them.
Insulting people by realising that there are people with different political objectives that live in this country and reaching out to them. That's insulting people, is it?
I'll tell you what, Stephen, they're nailing their colours to the mask when they come around getting votes. So if it's insulting, that's our problem, not mine. What were you saying? Flyers coming through the door.
What do you want them to do?
I want them to do what they say to do on the side of the pin, Stephen. That's fight Sinn Féin, fight for Protestant equality, fight for British communities.
So not fight for equality for everybody, just Protestants?
No, I said British communities. I said British communities. We have multi-ethnic people in the British community, Stephen, and I've championed the course for a lot of
years. What about Irish communities in Northern Ireland?
Sorry?
What about Irish people who live here?
Stephen, that's not my problem. It's whatever they're putting in the flyers. They're saying they're going to fight Sinn Féin. So they're fighting. Well, a Sinn Féin British or Irish. What is Sinn Féin, Stephen?
Former DUP Director of Policy, now with the TUV. Dan Boucher's with us this morning. Morning to you, Dan.
Morning.
Good morning. So here you have now, Dan, the DUP saying they're going to have this focus on bread and butter issues. They're going to be people-centred.
Yep. I think that's misses the fundamental underlying constitutional questions that, you know, haven't been resolved and that remain unresolved. And obviously, you know, you can pursue bread and butter issues in any political context. You can do that as part of the Republic of Ireland. You can do that part of the UK. But the obviously, as a unionist party, one's responsibility is to do that in the context of being part of the United Kingdom. And so the fact that there is a border in the Irish Sea, as much as one might want to try and get away from constitutional questions to talk about bread and butter issues, the border in the Irish Sea is still there. And of course, it does have many significant...
Well, the border in the Irish Sea is still there. And while the border in the Irish Sea is still there, your British government is saying it will implement the Windsor Framework.
Yeah, and that's, from my perspective, that's not a responsible thing for any country to treat part of itself. Any government's primary responsibility is to treat everyone equally.
Do you congratulate,
and to ensure that everyone has equal citizenship.
Do you congratulate your unionist opponents, the DUP, on delivering that 15% extra subsidy on childcare for people in Northern Ireland?
Yes, I have no issue with that. But the issue is clearly that we need to be addressing the underlying constitutional problems that we, you know, are looking at the moment. Obviously, at the beginning of the year, we were led to believe that those constitutional problems had been dealt with. Now, there is a focus on practical bread and butter issues. Obviously, at the end of the day, we all need to have a focus on bread and butter issues. The TUV has a focus on bread and butter issues. But you have to have that in the context of understanding those constitutional issues. Well, not having a border in the Irish Sea means that we... you know, disenfranchised in 300 areas of law. That's a bread and butter issue because that affects us very practically. The law is made that impacts our lives in a very bread and butter way. We can't change it because we're not actually reflected in the legislature that's making those laws.
You've goaded me to ask the question, Dan. So what bread and butter issue is the TUP focused on?
The TUV? There are obviously lots of different bread and butter issues, but just one for starters. It is obviously the fact that Northern Ireland isn't being funded to need at the moment. And one of the points that we have made is you click Scotland. Scotland is funded £21 above need at the moment. We would say that just because Scotland is funded so very generously doesn't mean that we have a right to claim.
But in terms of... Let's take education, because the Education Minister was on the programme. So what are you delivering for children in Northern Ireland? What's your policy?
Well, if you just let me answer the question, Stephen, I was right in a little bit. It'll take a little bit longer now. Because we haven't been funded to need, we're very clear that Wales was funded below need and that we want the same rights as Wales, which means that we want to be funded to the definition of need and also to have something called the uplift. Wales is not just funded
I think every political party in Northern Ireland is calling for that, aren't they?
We're calling for something a little bit different, Stephen, a little bit more nuanced, something that people have missed. People have recognised to some degree the Holton formula, which Wales negotiated, which means they're funded to need. But Wales have something else on top of that, which people are not talking about, called the uplift, which was worth £1.17 billion.
But it's about how you would spend that uplift when we're talking about bread and butter issues. Take any government department in Stormont and tell me what extra you would deliver for people who live here.
Well, we're fighting for that £1.17 billion in the uplift.
That's the uplift. Take any government department and say how you would change someone's life here? Any government department. Fill your boots.
Well, we would obviously put the money in all the different departments.
Take one of them.
Education is a massively important economic development.
Education. What would you do? Is your party real in terms of real policies for real people? What would you do in education?
We would address the underfunding of people per head funding, which is less than across the UK.
What would you do?
If we secured the uplift, which no one...
Yes, I've heard about the uplift. What would you do, for example, for children? What would you do?
I just said if we got the uplift, we'd have £1.17 billion.
Yeah, and what would you do? Take a snapshot of that £1.1 billion. What would you do for children?
Well, we would invest it in. For example, there was the issue this morning about underfunding in the real estate of schools, and we would be able to do that. Just think about it, £1.17 billion, Stephen. People talked a lot about the DUP with the confidence and supply agreement getting an extra billion. We're talking about getting more than that. We're talking about £1.17 billion.
Dan,
and no one has talked about this before.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you. That's Dan Boucher from the TUV. Here comes the news at 10 o'clock. Good morning, everyone. 030-30-80-55-55. If you're picking up the phone this morning, don't forget, if you've got a story for us, send it into the BBC, nolan@bbc.co.uk. nolan@bbc.co.uk. And some of the biggest news stories that there have been in this country over recent years have started with that one email into this programme. We have a team here. We're ready to fight for you. So nolan@bbc.co.uk. And our podcast, of course, going out every single day. You can listen to the programme whenever you want to, and you'll find the podcast on BBC Sounds. Andy Allen, the Ulster Unionist Party MLA, former soldier, Mr. Allen lost both his legs in an explosion in Afghanistan in 2008, now uses a wheelchair, and wait for this, couldn't get on a plane and was left stranded last night on the tarmac at Birmingham Airport. We've been hearing about this in the news this morning, and Andy's with us now. Andy, good morning.
Good morning, Stephen.
Left stranded on the tarmac literally outside the plane.
Yeah, initially for several minutes, there wasn't an ambulance there, so we were there a couple of minutes, and then one of the dispatchers came over and asked us to go back inside. We went back inside, and he came in thereafter and appeared to have a conversation on the phone with special assistants who provide the service to get disabled passengers onto the aircraft. And he had suggested that they advised him they would be approximately 10 minutes. But the point that it came apparent to me that things probably weren't going as well as what we had hoped was when he was leaving the room, he asked us if we have any home luggage. And obviously, I was curious as to why he was asking that. So I surmised at that stage perhaps they were going to take us off the flight, and that's what transpired.
So were able-bodied people literally walking past you on the tarmac into that plane?
Yes.
And you're sitting there in your wheelchair, and they left you sitting there?
Yes, so they didn't leave me per se. The special assistance operator was with me, and he obviously apologised that the ambulance wasn't in situ. But they then took us back, and they didn't have the service in place, even though they knew they needed it.
But this is Aer Lingus, right?
Aer Lingus was the airline, yes.
A massive brand. They're owned by the IAG group. IAG own British Airways. They own Aer Lingus. This is a household brand. They're going to say it was the airport's problem, no doubt. Here's the statement from Aer Lingus. They're apologising. They recognise the challenges, they said, faced by customers with disabilities. Committed to doing all we can to assist all customers. Emerald Airlines have reached out to the customer directly to offer a heartfelt apology for this incident and have commenced a full investigation. So you go back into the airport and you say, Andy, I'm not going to be treated like this. What did they say to you?
So we were escorted back through to essentially the main entrance where the special assistance desk is, and we were left there for approximately 40-45 minutes, during which time we were up and down the airport speaking with various different people to try to get an understanding as to what was going on, what we were to do. Eventually a supervisor from the airport came, and they had a conversation with us, asked us what accommodation, if any, we had on this side, i.e. in Birmingham. We advised them nothing, and they then said that they would provide accommodation and a return flight today. And in terms of Aer Lingus, now I appreciate, obviously, it would be highlighted that they do not operate the spice assistance service themselves. But I sat on the plane on many different occasions where paperwork being completed has delayed the flight by 10, 15, 20 minutes. On this occasion, the airline staff, from what I have had conveyed to me, opted not to wait a further 5 minutes. As I understand from the airport, the ambulance was en route to the plane and the operator opted not to wait for.
So that is that's a pretty damning accusation that you're making. You're essentially saying that Aer Lingus would not wait another 5 minutes and therefore chose to leave disabled people without a flight home in order to save 5 minutes. Like that, are you sure about that?
Well, Stephen, that's what I've been told. What the operators told me was that it was en route. Would it have taken 5 minutes to get me onto the plane? It may have taken a bit more in terms of the overall context of how long it would have took to get me on the plane. Obviously, I'm not au fait with aviation rules, etc. It may well be a justifiable explanation as to the aircraft had to leave within a certain time slot. But no one from the airline has engaged with me in that respect. No one. So if they were sincere in their apology, I would have had extensive engagement with them already. They haven't. Majorly, in part, it's not their fault in terms of
their passenger.
Special assistance. Yep, no, they didn't provide special assistance, and it is the airport's responsibility, they would say. But my argument is, and from the information that's been conveyed to me from some of the ground team, that the ambulance was en route. Again, I'm happy to have that statement clarified, but that is what was conveyed to me as I was sitting in the terminal area waiting, that the ambulance, the special assistance team told me it was en route.
Birmingham Airport, we work closely with our assisted travel provider, Mighty, to deliver the highest possible customer service to all our passengers. Unfortunately, on this occasion, due to technical issues, it's all this coded language within the statements, you know, technical issues. What does that mean? Was it a technical issue that the airlift wasn't available on time? Was it a technical issue, as you claim, that they wouldn't wait another few minutes for it to get there. What do they mean by this? They're saying that they will fully investigate this matter, and you've been rebooked on a flight for today. And they're apologising to you. Have Birmingham Airport spoken to you directly?
All of my engagement thus far, unless I'm mistaken, has been through Birmingham Airport staff. The supervisor was from Birmingham Airport. I've just been brought to the gate by two of the special assistance staff who are obviously the operator for the assisted travel service. To my knowledge, I have not had any interaction or engagement bar at the check-in desk with Aer Lingus whatsoever. And I'm happy for my statement to be clarified. I'm conveying information that was conveyed to me on the ground last night that the ambulift was en route. I put a time frame on it that they indicated to me how long it would take for the ambulift to transit from one part, wherever it was, in terms of the service it was providing to the aircraft I was at. And I was advised that the aircraft couldn't wait any longer.
What does it feel like, Andy, to be a disabled person who is being treated like this? What's the dominant emotion? Does it anger you? Does it humiliate you? What is it?
I think it would be fair to say, Stephen, there was a broad range of emotions last night. There was frustration, there was anger, and there were other emotions I can't fully explain, where I felt lesser in that I couldn't get on that aircraft, even though I had done everything that was required of me. I would fully stick my hands up if I arrived late and didn't notify that I required assistance. That would be on me. But on this occasion, when booking the flight, I filled out the form. I selected the relevant categories in terms of being unable to climb the aircraft stairs and being unable to walk down the aisle. So they had all of the information. As I understand it, there are pressures with these specialist vehicles, the ambulift as they call them, and the airport is very aware of the challenges that they have, and it seems to me there were no mitigating circumstances, no mitigating measures put in place to try to prevent it, and what unfolded last night was a result of that.
It's up to you whether you would do it or not, but technically, can you sue them for discrimination?
It's not something that I've even contemplated at the moment.
Why not, to teach them a lesson? Why not?
So for me, well, look, I'll explore all options. For me, the key thing here is it's not about Andy Allen per se. This is about a wider issue, and I'm already being contacted by people who are highlighting issues with assistance that they've experienced. But I must say, Stephen, and this is an important point, you know, I have travelled through a broad range of airports since acquiring my injury, and many of them have been fantastic. Belfast Airport, Belfast International. Now, I appreciate others may not have the same experiences, but I can only speak for myself. They have been fantastic coming out through the city. Yeah. The service was second to none. They had me on the plane. They had me on the plane promptly, safely, and ahead of all the other passengers, so they can obviously get me onto the plane safely.
We think about what you did, how you came to lose your legs. You were fighting in a war, putting yourself in the very middle of danger in Afghanistan in 2008. That's how you lost your legs. And this lot couldn't lift you onto a plane. And they're claiming in statements to the BBC that they're reaching out to you, and you're telling me you haven't heard from them.
To my knowledge, no one from Aer Lingus, at least no one from Aer Lingus, has made themselves known to me when they're engaging with me.
Well, they claim Emerald Airlines have reached out to you to offer a heartfelt apology. If it had been a heartfelt apology, you'd know about it.
Well, I would like to think so. All the people that I've engaged with have made themselves known to me as being airport staff. So I can only assume that Emerald Airlines haven't reached out to me.
Andy, thanks for bringing this the story. Thank you for talking to us. Appreciate it. That's the Ulster Unionist Party MLA, Andy Allen. Phillip's in Belfast. Morning, Philip.
Hi, Stephen. I just wanted to make a point there. See, I have a lot more respect for politicians who have come up through, you know, working class areas where they know what the issues are. I'm not saying...
This is back to the DUP and Gavin Robertson saying that they'll be doing things differently internally and externally.
Well, that's a broad brush, Stephen. That's well good, but we'll have to wait and see. I just want politics to work here. I really do, for everyone, not just all that nonsense with Protestants, Catholics, or whatever else. Like, I just want to see it work for everyone.
So, what would your test be of it working?
I have no. Well, More affordable homes, maybe a lot more help for the NHS, better AI for jobs of people with the shortages of work. Who knows, possibly robots. I know it sounds a bit weird.
See,
for some
affordable homes is such a big issue across the across all our communities in Northern Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is there any political party that's actually, you know, punching through for you in terms of a strategy to deliver that?
Whenever the general election comes around, Stephen, I vote for them all in corresponding numbers because that's what, you know, the soldiers fought for in the wars, freedom of speech and everything like that. And
right.
So, I mean, I would go probably, I'm probably more middle ground, but it just varies. I would vote for them all. So would.
Philip, thank you. Alex, next morning, thanks. Alex. Thanks, Philip. Morning, Alex.
Morning. I just listened to this, Paul Given this morning and talk about Brexit. And, you know, the simple truth is, and one of your callers highlighted this, when the DUP undermined Theresa May, they went for a hard Brexit. And really, from a unionist point of view, the best thing they could have had was a soft Brexit. And the simple truth is, for the DUP to achieve this perfection they want in terms of the Irish Sea border, they're going to have to see Brexit softened considerably, and Labour will probably do that. But again, that's against their position. They want a hard Brexit. They probably still do.
Thank you, Alex. Jane, next morning, Jane.
Morning, Stephen. There's all this chat about the new Gavin's is talking about the new DUP. The first thing and the priority would be, could they have an undertaking to tell the truth? The last time when Geoffrey Donaldson said that it was done away with, Gavin Robinson was a cheerleader. All we want is these people to be truthful, but they can't do it.
Well, Gavin Robinson saying they were cautiously optimistic.
Oh yes, but I mean whenever
cautiously, he's calling for cautious realism.
Well, I'm calling for truth. We've heard a pack of lies, and people don't like it. I mean, the border, it was everything was honky dory. It was all sorted out. It wasn't all sorted out, and Gavin Robinson was party to that.
Well, I can tell you now that at the time, Jane, that the DUP were telling you essentially that the Irish Sea border was gone. At the time they were sending you that message, there were very, very senior people within the DUP speaking to me behind the scenes, telling me that what they were doing meant that the party would pay a long-term political price, that people would not trust them for a long time.
I will never trust them again, never, because you can watch a thief, but you can't watch a liar.
Well, what Gavin Robinson is saying is that the party will change internally. If you look at what Jonathan Buckley was saying at the weekend at the same conference, Jonathan was talking about learning lessons.
They're slow learners.
Well, what do you want them to do?
I want them to simply tell the truth. They told the DUP, under Geoffrey Donaldson, told us a pack of lies. And if all these people who thought he was wrong, why did they not come up openly and declare it under cover? Sure, who cares? The fact was he tried to sell us something which we knew wasn't true, and that really gets up my. It's really offensive.
Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Morning to you. 20 past 10, the Nolan Show from the BBC. The Israeli military says it's conducting extensive airstrikes on Hezbollah targets in Lebanon as cross-border attacks between the two sides continue to ratchet up. Let's find out what's going on. Sally Abu Al-Joud, Beirut-based journalist for L'Orient Today. Good morning to you, Sally.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tell us what's been happening, Sally.
Yeah, here in Lebanon, we've never been closer to a wider war with Israel. The tensions are really high. Israel intensified its strikes on Lebanon, mainly in the eastern sectors in southern Lebanon. Dozens of villages have been receiving strikes since the morning. Within a second, more than 50 strikes happened on southern Lebanon. Also, people since the morning have been receiving messages on their telephone. Someone has been calling them on the telephone at their home, telling them to evacuate. We're also talking about residential areas in central Beirut. Even the Minister of Information in Lebanon received such a message also to evacuate the ministry. You know, this follows a week of last week was very tense here, and we've seen the most violent day since October 8th when this war started with Israel.
And so, look, we are so far away from this here where we're broadcasting from in Northern Ireland that we're seeing the pictures, we're seeing the distressing images of human misery on our screens, Sally. What feels different about this now? Is it because it could escalate even further, and in what way?
I mean, like I said, we feel that we've never been closer to a wider war since October 8th, since this conflict started with Israel, because of the escalation, because of the intensification of these strikes on Lebanon. We heard Israel say that its main goal right now is to return its residents to the north, and they did say that the center of gravity is shifting from Gaza to the north, which is the confrontation with Lebanon. And today has been, you know, everyone's on edge. Everyone's waiting to see what's happening. Israel has been threatening since the morning. People receiving, you know, this is direct now. People are receiving messages on their phones. Even we heard some, on the radio telling them to evacuate, telling them to leave places that are close to Hezbollah centers and weapons. But the thing is, you know, people don't know where these are. People also told me they don't know where to go. Go where? Who will host us? One person told me, you know, we are meant to die. Some of these areas are in residential areas. We just heard that one house, which was full of civilians, was targeted. We're still receiving more news on that.
Naeem Qassem, who is the deputy leader for Hezbollah, has said, we've entered a new phase, namely an open reckoning with Israel.
That's correct. Well, we are seeing threats on both sides, but mainly this started with Israel, with escalating its operations on Lebanon after it said that it wants to return its residents to the north. However, Hezbollah chief responded to that, saying that the only way to do that is a ceasefire in Gaza, is for the war to end in Gaza. But it seems that Israel's strategy right now is to escalate in order to de-escalate, but everyone's questioning how that could happen. Its strategy is to, you know, they want to return more their citizens to the northern Israel, but they seem to be evacuating more people, as well as in Lebanon, people are evacuating from, the south.
Sally, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning. Thank you. Back to our local issues, Robert Nice Belfast. Morning, Robert.
Hey, good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Talking about people with and wheelchair users, give me two examples. If you come out of George Best Airport and you're an able person, you'll get a taxi right away.
Can I ask you something before you get into that?
No, let me finish, Stephen.
Well, let me ask
come
you this.
Stephen, you've cut me off right away.
I will forget, though.
Let me finish.
Do they still call it George Best?
Let us finish.
But just help me with this, and then we'll get into that story. Do they still call it George Best, or have they dropped that from the name?
Well, it's new to me. That's what I'm led to believe is called the George Best Airport.
All right, okay.
I didn't hear otherwise. Now, you're a frequent user of the George Best Airport. Why don't you make inquiries?
Yes, we'll have to. I'll ask them. Okay.
That is still a George Best Airport. So
go ahead with your story.
You got to pronounce something properly, you know.
Yeah. The website apparently is now called, what is it? Belfast City Airport, I'm told. Belfast City Airport. They've dropped George Best from the website.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, you see. And then you were having to go at me for interrupting.
I'm sorry about that.
That's anyway, apology accepted.
Let's get back to the main issue. If you committed at George Best Airport,
yes,
and you require a taxi, you get one right away. A disabled person comes out, it has to wait, they'll have to call in a taxi. And my point is, you can't run a two-tier system like that. Now, if you phone up any of the taxi companies and you're an able person, you'll get a taxi right away. And if you're a disabled person, you're going to have to wait or maybe not get one. So my point is, you can't run a two-tier system when you're catering for members of the public.
Yeah. How difficult is it? How many disability access taxis are there? Are there many on the road?
Well, you know, all public hire taxis, disabled taxis, are in the taxi ranks. We get complaints from time to time that people had to leave their residences and go down onto the main roads and buses in the city centre and public hire taxis home because the private taxis don't seem to have any accessible taxis.
Okay. Robert, listen, thank you. I want to look into that other wee story because I'm being told here that they have dropped it from their website. Has that been talked about while I've been away? George Best, Belfast City Airport, dropping George Best from the name of the airport? We'll have to check that out. We'll see why it's not on the website. Stephen in Antrim. Morning, Stephen.
Hi, good morning. I really enjoyed your little Al Jazeera broadcast interview there. Just breaking up the theme of our local concerns. I listened very carefully.
Well, we're talking about people dying, aren't we?
Stephen.
We're not talking about Al Jazeera, and I'm not too sure you should be flippant when we're talking about men, women, children on all sides dying, Stephen.
Yeah, let's go back to October the 7th then, shall we?
Certainly.
Nice little insert. You had a flow going there, getting actual feedback from the public, and it all seemed to have the one theme. And that is, I listened very carefully to Paul Given this morning. Every single word that he said was typical DUP, ambiguous communication. Okay, the DUP simply decided for this party conference they're going to be pouring old wine into new bottles.
Well, it wasn't ambiguous, was it, when he talked specifically about specific percentages for childcare, for example?
Well, let's ask him. You didn't ask him. I'll ask him. Where did he get the money from for this? Because, you see, so much of
I asked him if he was going to overspend in order to pay for it.
But where did the money come from, Stephen? Because at the heart of our problems here is that we don't know through the executive office's little decision-making process how much of the monies that come through the Barnett consequentials are spent on pet projects. Children's education doesn't improve because you put up new schools.
You're calling childcare a pet project? Well, subsidising childcare?
Who's responsible for childcare, Stephen?
What are you talking about?
Well, isn't it parents who are responsible in the first instance?
All right. So now you're having a pop with parents, some of whom are out doing two and three jobs and can't afford. How much is childcare, Stephen? Do you realise how much it is? How expensive it is?
I've heard all of this talk, and it would make very poor economic sense. I've already heard a lot of parents saying this, that they can't afford, you see, to pay for childcare. So they give up their jobs in order to stay at home and look after their children.
So how do they pay the bills then?
Well, you see, you cut your cloth according to your circumstances.
It's that easy. Here, I'm in a job. Forget it's that easy. I've got a child. Let's just give up the jobs.
Stephen, You see, you're very good at hectoring and, you know, intervening. You've done this. You're only back 10 minutes.
I know. My blood pressure's up already. Yeah. You and I can talk tomorrow if you want, Stephen. Thank you for your company. Thanks, everyone. See you in the morning.
Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @ Stephen Nolan.